Appreciate the fine introduction, and it's a joy to be back at Kearns. I feel at home because I spent many years here, and we feel very close to this congregation. And thank you for coming. So close to dinner time that I didn't think you'd make it, but you made it. I appreciate our brethren from North Carolina and being on the same program with them this afternoon. And I'm glad that I have the opportunity to speak on a very wonderful subject. Moses and the University of Egypt. I think that whoever assigned me this topic was thinking about the University of Hard Knocks. And that's the way we'll take it. Because Moses had some hard knocks in Egypt. And we want to talk about what he learned, and so we can learn from what he learned, and we will all be wiser if we take this great lawgiver as our example. In the second chapter of Exodus, we learn about the birth of Moses. Moses was just one of three children. Amram and Jochebed were of the tribe of Levi, and so the children were in this order. There was Miriam, and then there was Aaron, and then Moses was the youngest of the children. You can't say that they were of the elite class in Egypt because they were born in slavery. And they had been in slavery for many years. As Brother Ed pointed out this morning, there arose a king that knew not Joseph. And so the king who knew not Joseph kept them in bondage because he was afraid that this great nation of Hebrew people would rise up and join with the enemies against the Egyptians. And so the king made a decree for all the male babies to be killed. But the parents of Moses saw that he was a goodly child. He was well formed, and so they decided to hide him for 3 months. And so they were not afraid of the king. Josephus gives us an account of what happened about the time that Moses was hid. It says that he was put in the current, that is, in the stream. Now, the scriptures don't say that he was put in the current, but rather that he was put in the flags. In other words, they were protective of this little child. They weren't trying to drown him, they were trying to save him. And so when Thermuthis, the name given to us by Josephus, the Bible doesn't give us that name, came down to the river to wash, she found this little baby. And when she opened the little basket after sending the maid for this little ark of bulrushes, the babe wept. And that appealed to the compassionate heart of this female. I don't know of anything that would appeal to the compassion of a woman more than to hear the cry of a baby. Miriam, the child who had been watching over the babe, suggested that she find a Hebrew mother to nurse the child. And all that the daughter of Pharaoh said was, go. And that meant that you can do it. She went and brought back the mother of the child. And that was God's providence working in the affairs of his people. You can see the providence of God throughout this whole story. Because Moses was enabled not only to obtain great education from the wisdom of the Egyptians, but at the knee of a mother who was God-fearing. No education without God is of any eternal value. And so Moses had the providence of God to protect him. The midwives protected him because they would not kill the male babies as the king had decreed. And probably Thermuthis was the catalyst to keep this decree from really going into effect, because she loved this little Hebrew baby. In Hebrews 11:23, we read that the parents of Moses were honored by faith. The parents of Moses hid him for 3 months. So God was working through his providence by the faith of parents to save this little boy who became later the lawgiver, the leader of Israel. They were giving their best effort to this child. So he learned a lot of things at his mother's knee. He learned some things that he wouldn't have learned in the schools of Egypt. He learned there was a God in heaven. He learned that values of a moral nature are superior to morals in the social and in the physical realm. He learned that God protects his people and watches after them. And so he had a plan to preserve this whole nation. We learn what God did through women. Think of the women who were involved in this great story. The midwives, Miriam, Jochebed, Thermuthis, all of these were used by the Lord to protect this boy and to help him to become the great leader that he was. The time came for Moses to become old enough to be taken to the house of Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses. I'm told by Adam Clark in his commentary that the word Mo in the Egyptian language meant water, and Eusis meant one saved from the water. So when you combine these two words, it becomes Moses. Josephus tells us a fanciful story. He sometimes is carried away by his imagination, that when Moses was a small child, Thermuthis brought him to Pharaoh and said, "Now, in case I don't have any more children, I want this child to be heir to the throne," at which time Pharaoh placed the diadem on the head of the child. According to Josephus, he took it off, threw it down, and trampled upon it. Now, you can accept that for what it is from an uninspired writer. I don't put a lot of credibility in that story. But Moses finally grew up to become a man, and he made a decided choice. According to the writer of Hebrews, we read, "By faith Moses, when he came of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter." Now, the writer of Hebrews leaves it to Exodus 2 to tell us the details. Stephen tells us some of it in the book of Acts, the 7th chapter, when he recounts the history of the Hebrew people. But we read that it happened in this way, that when Moses decided to go out and visit his people, he saw an Egyptian smiting one of the Hebrews. And he looked around every way, and when he did not see anybody, he killed the Egyptian. And so the next day when he went out, there were two Hebrews fighting. And one of the Hebrews, who was doing the wrong, said, "Why have you come out to be our judge? Are you a prince and a judge over us? Will you kill one of us like you did the Egyptian yesterday?" And Moses knew then that this word had gotten out, and that's why he fled. Now, if the smiting in that case, where the Egyptian was smiting the Hebrew, meant kill, then Moses would have had a right under patriarchal law to kill that Egyptian. That was the way patriarchal law was. And so when Moses fled, we wonder in Hebrews 11:27, where it says, "Moses forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king," how that can be reconciled with this fact. Well, I think Moses was just following the old adage that discretion is the better part of valor. What could one man do against the whole Egyptian army? But not fearing the wrath of the king evidently applies to the time when he came back. And he led the people out. He showed great courage in approaching the king. Pharaoh, when Pharaoh was so hostile to the Hebrew people, demanding that Pharaoh let the people go. The question arises at this point, was Moses the general of the Egyptian army? Now, of course, nothing is said in the Bible about this in detail, but Josephus tells the story that the Ethiopians had made some inroads into Egypt and taken some of their possessions. And so Moses led an army of Egyptians. He didn't take the sea route, he took the land route, but it was filled with serpents, with snakes. And so he took along a basket of birds called abs, or abies. We have a bird down in Trinidad called abis, which is our Trinidad bird. I don't know whether it's the same kind of bird or not. But these birds were hostile to snakes. And so when Moses took the birds along, they devoured the snakes, and he made the trip with the soldiers and attacked in a surprising sort of way the Ethiopians, took their cities, and the Egyptians fled to an isle in the Nile around the river. It happened, according to Josephus, that Tharbis, the king's daughter, saw Moses, fell in love with him, sent her servant to make a proposal of marriage to him. And when he received that proposal of marriage, he agreed to do it on one condition: if you deliver the city into our hand. And so Josephus says she delivered up the city, he consummated the marriage, and then later went back with his soldiers back home. He had won the victory. Now believe what you will of that. But some of it may be true, because in Acts the 7th chapter, Stephen said, Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and was a man that was mighty in word and deed. Acts 7, 25, 22. So Moses had a great influence in his day. Joseph had a great influence in his day. Now, Joseph and Moses were both in the palace. One of them was censured, but one of them was not. One of them turned his back. In other words, he didn't want to stay in the palace. He refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Joseph was not censured for staying in command with Pharaoh. Now, the difference is that there were different circumstances. It was essential to Israel in Joseph's day, for Joseph to have the position that he had, and to enable his family to come down in the land of Goshen and have that settlement. But when there arose a king that knew not Joseph, and then another king after him, both of them were hostile. And so it was time for God to fulfill his promise, to lead his children out of Egyptian bondage. He had said in the 15th chapter of Genesis that the Israelites would be in a strange land for 400 years. And so now the time had come for God to fulfill his promise to lead those people out. Moses made a choice. He chose affliction rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Robert Burns, in his beautiful poem Tam O'Shanter, says, "Pleasures are like poppies spread. You seize the flower, the bloom is shed. Or like a snowflake on the river, a moment white, and then melts forever." Moses knew that. He knew that principle. He made the choice that was right, the only right choice that he could make. He had to be with his people, even though they were persecuted. He esteemed the reproach of Christ greater treasures than that of the treasures of Egypt. You wonder why that this is called the reproach of Christ, because Christ had not entered into the world. But according to Paul in 2 Corinthians 5:21, Christ was made to be sin for us, that we might be made the righteousness of God in him. So in a sense, every affliction that has been suffered by God's people has been for Christ's sake, extending on back from Christ, back into the time of Moses. Paul had that idea when he said in Colossians 1:24, "I make up in my body that which is lacking in the afflictions of Christ. And then he said that he would have fellowship with him in his sufferings, Philippians 3:16. Do you think that Moses made a mistake when he made this choice to cast his lot with an afflicted people? We only have to turn to our New Testament to find out that he did not. Because we read that in Matthew 17, when Jesus was on the Mount of Transfiguration, there appeared with him Moses and Elijah. And they were talking about his decease, or the exodus of Jesus, his departure from this world. Why would a great servant of God be allowed to come before the presence of the Lord and talk with him if he had not made the right choice? God honored him. And then we read in the book of Revelation, the 15th chapter and verse 3, that when we get to heaven, we'll all sing the song of Moses and the Lamb. Now, the next part of Exodus 2 talks about Moses in Midian. In the land of Midian, Jethro had 7 daughters. And when Moses arrived there after fleeing from Egypt, he went to the place where the daughters were watering their flock. And they had filled the trough with water, but the shepherds came to drive them away. And Moses came to the rescue of these young women. And he watered their flock for them and helped them. And when they went home, their father Jethro said, "Why are you here so soon?" They explained that a man came and helped them. And so he said, "Well, why don't you go and send for him so that we can feed him bread?" So they went and got Moses, and then he was content to dwell with them. And Jethro presented him with his daughter Zipporah for a wife. They had 2 children, Gershom, which means "I was a stranger in a foreign land." And there are many translations, ancient translations, that have Exodus 18:4 inserted here after Exodus 2:22. And I think rightfully it belongs there, according to Exodus 4:20, because it said he took his sons out, not just one son, but sons. Exodus 18:4 says he had a son named Eliezer, which meant "God is my help to deliver me from the sword of Pharaoh." God was anxious to help his people because he'd made a promise, he'd made a covenant with them, that they would be 400 years in bondage. And so he had made a covenant with Abraham. Great nation covenant, great seed promise, which was fulfilled in Christ, and then a great land promise, which was fulfilled in the days of Joshua when they came into the land. And so it was time now to move on with this promise that God had made, this covenant. And so his marvelous providence is seen. Let's look at some lessons we can gain from the second chapter of the book of Exodus. God's providence is seen throughout this. He had made his promise that he would protect his people. And now they're cries and their groans go up, and he hears them, and he acknowledges them as his children. He remembers the covenant that he'd made with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. Our Bible tells us that all things work together for good to those who love the Lord, even to those who are called according to his purposes. Notice we must be called according to his purpose, not our own. That God will help us, that he will work it out for us some way, if we will trust in him and lean upon him and not upon our own understanding. What a marvelous thing to realize that God's providence hovers over us. And then I can learn from this chapter, we all can learn, that God hears the prayers of his people. And that's wonderful to think about, that we can just talk to God with the assurance that he hears us. He heard his people back then. They were being afflicted. It was not through any fault of their own. It was just God's providence working out something for his people that was better. And so he heard them and delivered them. In Hebrews, the 4th chapter, the writer says, we have not an high priest who cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but one who in all points hath been tempted, like as we are, yet without sin. So he concludes, let us therefore draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find help for ourselves in time of need. So God hears the prayers of his people. We can learn from Old Testament examples like the children of Israel. God heard them, and surely we're his people today. He'll hear us. He heard Elijah when Elijah prayed for rain, and there was a cloud that arose the size of a man's hand, and then there was the sound of abundance of rain. And so James tells us about that in James, the 5th chapter, in verse 17 and 18. In 1 Peter 2:12, Peter said, the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears unto their supplication. But the face of the Lord is against them that do evil. So we have the assurance that if we are his people, if we're trying to work out his plans, if we're trying to do his work in his church, then our prayers will be heard. I think another lesson that we learn from this is the value of hard work. There are many who appear in this story of Exodus that joined in the hard work. The midwives were among those that we read about in the first chapter that Brother Ed talked about this morning. They were those who refused to kill the male babies as the king had decreed. They worked hard. And they gave a good answer to Pharaoh when the authorities questioned the midwives. They said, well, it's because of the fact that the Hebrew children are lively and they give birth more readily. In other words, the Egyptian women lived in luxury and it was harder for them to bear children. And so their excuse was, we can't get there in time, they've already delivered. Then again, we read in the case of Thermuthis, that she was down to wash. Now, one translation said she came down to wash herself, but the word herself is in italics and interpolation. I think she was down to wash clothes because there's an ancient custom that the princesses of kings would do the washing. They would serve as the laundry for the family. And so if that's so, she was a hard worker too. And she came down to wash. That's when she saw the baby and kept that baby. And then there was Moses, who worked over in Midian. And there were the daughters of Jethro, who were watering the flock. They were working. Now, our Bible tells us that if we work, we can eat. Paul said to the Thessalonian brethren, if any man will not work, neither let him eat. He said in Ephesians 4, let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor with his hands, working to have to give to him that hath need. This principle of industry is a Hebrew principle. It is a Christian principle. The Hebrew people were told that if they did not teach their children a trade, they taught him to steal. And we need to teach our children to work and not to receive things just for nothing, but to work for their living. Romans 12:11, Paul said, be diligent in business and serve the Lord. Then we have a lesson of the values of hardship. It seems that when people have hardships, it causes them to look upward. There's an old saying that when you're flat of your back, there's only one place to look, and that's up. And so when we have hardships, we're prone to look upward. That doesn't mean that everybody that has hardship will be saved by virtue of that hardship alone. But that hardship can soften him up and make him think about the God who created him. So sinners oftentimes in affliction will look up to God and will give praise to him. The 73rd Psalm is a beautiful psalm. In that psalm, the writer said, my feet almost slipped, And the thing that caused him to slip was he looked around and he saw all the wicked people prospering. And he said, there must not be a God in charge up there, or he wouldn't let all this happen. All of these wicked people are prospering and the good people are suffering. But then he said, then I went into the sanctuary. And then I understood. In other words, when we go into God's word and deeply study it, that we can understand God's purposes. He's going to take care of the wicked people someday. We don't have to worry about that. If we do his will, he's going to see that everything will work out all right. He's going to see that we have what we need. He's going to see that the wicked people will have their just due in proper time. And so sinners in affliction oftentimes do wake up and they look up to God. Now our conclusion is to all of this wonderful story is, and Acts tells us this, that Moses was a type of Christ. When we read in the book of Acts, it says, quoting from the book of God in the Old Testament, it says that a prophet shall the Lord God raise up from among you like unto me. This is Moses talking. And to him shall you hearken in all things. And it shall come to pass that every soul that hearkeneth not to the voice of that prophet shall be utterly cut off from among his people. Now Moses was prophesying about Christ. So Moses is a type of Christ. So it is essential for us to study the life of this great man Moses, because he's a type of Christ. And we can learn great lessons from his life, from the life of the people that surrounded him. And when we know his teaching, we can know the teachings of Christ. One of the speakers this morning told us that Jesus said, if you didn't hear Moses' teaching, then how could you hear my teaching? And so when we hear the teachings of Moses, it prepares us better to hear the teachings of Christ. Of course, we're not under Moses. We're under Christ. But the teaching of Moses serves as a background to the teaching of Christ. Nearly every nation in the world that has made a set of laws has copied those laws from the law of Moses. Just think of the Ten Commandments and the wonderful things that God's word has brought to the world. Civilization, how men can get along with each other. That started with Moses. God gave those laws to Moses. And so may we profit from the teachings of Moses. Now it may be that somebody is in the audience today who's not a Christian. If you're not a child of God, we hope that you'll come in loving submission to the Lord and to his word, and give your heart, give your life to him. Serve him all the days of your life, just like Moses did. Moses was a faithful servant in his house. Jesus is God's son over his house. Let's give our life to Christ while we have the time and while we have the opportunity. Come believing his word, ready to obey it, whatever way you're subject to the gospel, while we stand, while we sing our song.